And good afternoon, a little bit after 1 o'clock. Together, we're listening to 90.7 on the FM dial. KPFK Los Angeles out of Santa Barbara County, 98.7 FM. And, of course, streaming for the world at kpfk.org. It's Intervision time. Hi, hello, howdy, Michael Benner, your host till 2 o'clock this afternoon. Friday Intervision. Intervision, a program about spirituality and health, a program about metaphysics and mysticism, about developing consciousness. And it's a show about motive and identity. And today we have a couple of guests. I'm really looking forward to doing this program today with each of our guests. And there's a lot of traffic. The Ventura's jammed up, the 5's jammed up, so one of my guests is running late. But Bill and Alexander, if you're listening to the radio, we switched the order, so you're cool till 1:30. And so my 1:30 guests are coming now. I don't know why I'm giving you these details, except that I guess I want Bill and Alex, if they are in traffic, to breathe a little easier. We're okay. We're doing fine. Let me get right to it. This first guest you may have seen on Larry King last week. I bet even more of you saw him in the film The Secret, which is, it's just a groundswell, such a hot buzz around this film. I think the hottest premium, certainly if not the first, the second hottest gift that we were providing listeners and subscribers during our recent fundraising, all across, all day parts, political programs, music programs, everybody, it seems, wants to see this film. And my guest today is one of the people featured in that film. He's also in town to do a breakthrough seminar, and we'll talk more about that. And with Thanksgiving coming up, of the many topics he talks about, I thought we'd talk about the amazing and wonderful power of gratitude. My guest is Dr. John DeMartini. Hello, John.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Welcome to KPFK in Los Angeles. You're from Texas someplace, right?
I'm originally from Houston, Texas.
Out of Houston.
Yes, I really don't reside there today. I travel pretty well most all the time, but I still have a headquarters in Houston, Texas.
Do you like travel?
I love travel.
You're doing these breakthrough workshops? Is that what keeps you on the road?
Yeah, that and many other programs I do. And so I've been blessed to speak. I've spoken and done that program in 52 countries, and I've traveled in about 86 countries, so I'm on the move.
Now, you're a chiropractor by trade. The doctor is a chiropractor, is
yes,
that right?
Yes, I'm retired from actual practice. I'm mainly full-time speaking, but I definitely align spines and minds of the divine to help people feel fine. And I used to practice galactic chiropractic and only accept space cases. That's what I used to tell people for fun.
That's great. That's sort of a wrapper on the side.
Well, my dream was to be a teacher, healer, and philosopher since I was 17 years old. I'm 52 now, so I have been focused on that. And chiropractic was so philosophically aligned to what I had been studying that I fell in love with it, because it believed that the body, mind, and spirit had an innate potential to bring healing. And there wasn't an excess of organs and a deficiency of drugs in beings. There was simply the power that made the body, that had the capacity to heal the body. And I just loved that, and I felt in tune with that. And I love working with my hands and hearts and minds with people.
So there was no transition from chiropractic to personal development. You've always been in that.
I was speaking all the way through chiropractic college. I made it through college doing what I'm doing today. And when I was in practice, I built a very large practice, one of the biggest in Texas, doing this. So I had health education awareness lectures, and I had my own television show, and I was doing radio on a regular basis and doing, I mean, this is what I love doing. So I've been doing this since I was almost a teenager.
Yeah, me too. I really do. The human potential movement, we called it in the late 60s and the early 70s, and then it began to change and grow. And, you know, watching you guys on Larry King the other night with my wife, Doreen, we were just sitting there and saying, well, finally, is this what it takes? I mean, the idea that basic metaphysics, personal responsibility has been made into sort of a partisan political issue when, of course, the concept is psychological, philosophical, even theological in a way. What do you think of the fact that The Secret and What the Bleep, and I mean, there have been so many wonderful books over the years. Is this the wave we've been waiting for?
Well, for so long, people have questioned whether or not the world was ready for these ideas in the general market, because the metaphysical community had been touting these ideas for many, many decades and possibly centuries when I think about it. But because even Aristotle referred to that everyone around you is a reflection and these types of things. So I guess it's just an idea whose time has come. And somebody had the courage to be willing to go through the ridicule, the opposition, and eventually the self-evidency to express what's true of the heart. And I believe that, that you know, it's sooner or later, if you persevere in something, that eventually it emerges. And the secret is an expression of the law of attraction, and the law of attraction is what the people behind it were using to create it. Larry King asked me on the show, John, do you think that this this attitude and this intention has any merit? Do you have any has any value? And I said, Larry, I can show you in my book of goals that I was going to sit here and talk to you, and here I am. So, yeah, absolutely. And I have a book of, I guess you'd call it a dream book, that I started when I was in 1972. I started 17, and that is a multi-volume set today. And I'm amazed at how, when we focus on something, how we create it.
A goals list.
If you want to call it that. It's very highly refined and articulated and re-edited clarity about what I want out of my life. Because I realize that if you don't plant flowers in the garden of your mind, you're going to always pull weeds.
This law of attraction, is it the same as Christ's admonition that you reap what you sow? Is it in relationships the golden rule? Is this really a principle from time out of mind?
I believe that is innately inside the human being and in the human psyche, this law of intention. We have a set of values, each of us, that's unique. It's like a fingerprint. And whatever is highest on our values is where our order and discipline is, and whatever is lower on our values is where our chaos is. And our hierarchy of values, this priority of value system, determines how we sense the world and act upon the world, how we attend to it and how we intend upon it. And so what's innermost in our being and what's most meaningful to us and most important to us is literally determining our intentions. And our innermost dominant thought, consciously or unconsciously, is expressing what's highest on our values and what's most important in our life. And we are literally, with our awareness, becoming aware of the opportunities to fulfill it. And we're acting on those opportunities accordingly. So we literally are manifesting and noticing all the synchronous opportunities that surround us because of having clear intention. So the secret describing this law of attraction is really taking something that has been known and putting it and articulating it in new ways and bringing it into a kind of a quantum world and demonstrating it for people and giving people permission to shine.
Can we say that one way of describing this secret, this law of attraction, is that life really is a self-fulfilling prophecy?
I'm a firm believer of that. I have a program that I even call the Prophecy Experience, and that is becoming the captain of your ship and the master of your destiny. I believe that you can create that. I'm a living example of what is known to be created. I mean, I've literally mapped out how I would love my life. And if I showed you the book and when it was written, because I've documented all these years, and you see how they're manifesting, it'd be impossible to convince me that it's not possible to create the life you dream about. It's absolutely doable.
Or that you worry about.
Because if you're distracted by infatuations or resentments, and you're exaggerating others and minimizing yourself or minimizing others and exaggerating yourself and are distracted by those things that consume space and time in your mind, then yes, even your fears and guilts can occupy your mind and you can continue to manifest that. But that's okay too, because that's bringing into your life the awareness that those things to be frightened about are illusions and they're not even real anyway.
Well, and one could also say, if they're optimistic enough, opportunities to learn.
That's exactly what they are.
Yeah, it's not all bad.
No, I don't even put those moral imperatives onto things. I don't find that productive.
Well, sometimes, especially neophytes, will talk about karma as if there's such a thing as bad karma, which to me seems like calling some gravity bad gravity.
I always say that with one person with one set of values, if you do something that challenges the values, they label it bad. To another person with a different set of values, they see that same activity as good. So how can we call it good or bad karma? It's really just an action, and people with different value systems react accordingly. And I always say, if you look carefully, there's a synchronicity in complementations of opposites, that there's always a supporter and challenger at the same moment to try to teach you that it wasn't about the duality of good and evil. It was about love.
You know, now that brings up the idea of the law of attraction in relationships, which I referred to a minute ago as certainly including the golden rule. But I'm talking, let's talk for a moment about romantic relationships, intense relationships, that what attracts us to another person, we always think of as the warm, fuzzy presence of love. But doesn't that attraction, that metaphysical, magnetic nature of consciousness or awareness, also include an attraction toward what each of us brings out of the other that needs healing?
Well, I always say that your soul makes sure that you have a homeostasis between support and challenge, because you may seek that which supports you, but you must attract also that which challenges you, because that which you're disowning in your life is what is there to be healed. So we go around, and we, because of our set of values, we go and seek things that support our values. We become infatuated. We put people on pedestals. We minimize ourselves. We tend to sacrifice ourselves for them and then discover that we're not really being who we really want to be and not loved for who we are by doing this. So then we take the person off the pedestal and we put them in the pit and we play the other side. But in reality, a true love is both support and challenge. I like to joke with people on stage. When you love somebody, you have a time when you're attracted and times when you're repelled, and times attracted and times repelled. And this is the very motion of lovemaking, the combination of attraction and repulsion. And this is what makes true love, the synthesis of these opposites, not the pole of one side.
Well, we all expect the warm fuzzies. I guess we're sort of naive about love. We all think that.
Well, I think that people are actually having what they think is love is actually the addiction of dopamine and endorphins inducing, because of the infatuation and things that they think support their values.
We're in love with the feeling of love.
Yeah, it's an addiction. And the real love is transcendent to the addictive phase. And it's something that is, I always say that true love is eternal. And the infatuation phase is a transient phase. And you have to distinguish between the two.
You're teaching in Los Angeles this weekend.
Yes, I'm here to do the breakthrough experience.
Tell us a little about it.
Well, when I was 17 years old, I almost died. I was living on the north shore of Oahu. And I met the great Paul Bragg, who was a great teacher, who was 93 at the time. And one night at a sunset recreation hall on the north shore of Oahu, he came to speak. And I just happened to be there. And I was this long-haired hippie surfer guy that just happened to be there. And I was blown away. I was brought to tears. I was inspired. And he helped me identify what I wanted to dedicate the rest of my life to, my mission. And that was 34 years ago in about a week. And
the Hawaiian guy?
Yeah, well, Paul Bragg was the guy that did Bragg's Amino Acids and health food stores. He set up American health food stores. He's an amazing guy.
I don't know the story of this.
Oh, he's an amazing guy.
I know the
He has a daughter who's 100 years old today, still lectures. And her name's Patricia Bragg.
Oh, my goodness.
Amazing person.
So is he like a kahuna shaman?
Or? No, he was an American person.
I see.
But he just was dedicated to health. And Jack Lane was one of his students and many people. Anyway, that night when I saw what I wanted to dedicate my life to, my life changed. Huge. I mean, it was like I was a hippie surfer guy making surfboards, and now I'm going to be a teacher kind of thing. From that night on, after him impacting me, I said that somehow in my own life, I want to do the same thing for other people. And so 34 years ago, I went on a quest to find a way for me to be able to be an inspiring teacher for other people to do what he did for me. So the breakthrough experience is what I have basically attempted to do is to synthesize the 34 years of research on human behavior and metaphysics and philosophy and personal development and synthesize that and bring out the best of the best I can bring to do exactly what he did for me, and that is help people find their mission and be inspired by it and clear and help to manifest that in their life.
Is this a 1 or 2 day workshop?
It's a 2 day program.
And what can you do in 2 days that's really a breakthrough for people?
Well, I've been blessed to develop a methodology, which is a series of very specific questions that allows people to see the hidden order in their daily apparent chaos. Because I truly believe there is a hidden order and a hidden intelligence that permeates the universe, that when we have true view, not partial view, instead of ignorance, we see whole and wisdom. When we do, we see a whole hidden order that's there. And we do, we open our heart with gratitude. And when we do, the voice and the vision on the inside becomes more profound than all opinions on the outside, and we begin to master our life. So I developed a method that's a science, a reproducible, duplicatable process that a person can take any piece of baggage that they experience. It could be relationship issues, it could be conflicts, it could be incest or rapes or whatever, it doesn't matter. There's a way of going through there, asking a series of questions, having a new awareness and a new perception about the event, and open your heart to the event and realize that it's all part of a perfection for your life. And it's guiding you and directing you. Because anything in your life you can't say thank you for becomes a burden and a baggage for you. And anything you can say thank you for becomes fuel of opportunity. So I help them see that. And
would you say that again? I just, forgive me.
I just said, well, heavy. anything you cannot say thank you for in your life, you have not seen truly. You've seen part of it. If you are infatuated with the past or resentful over the past and created fantasies or nightmares over an event, you're not seeing whole. Because when you're whole, you don't see fantasies or nightmares. You see love. And you see something to be appreciative of. And you see the hidden order of life. And anything that you have not seen that order of, becomes baggage and weighs you down. And instead of having the wisdom of the ages with the aging process, the method that I've developed is to help people have the wisdom of the ages without the aging process, to help them ask questions, to see the other side of what they're experiencing in the past or potential future, and see the balance of life. Because in truth, there is a balance. There's a homeostasis. In physics, they know that electromagnetism can never have a positive without a negative. They know in magnetism, you can never have a positive without a negative pole. But in human psychology, mythical psychology here, people are searching for a monopole. A happy without a sad, a kind without a cruel, a positive without a negative. And what they do is when they don't get that, then they feel hurt because they are addicted to a fantasy of a one-sided magnet in life. And our magnetism in life is surged to the degree that we can embrace both sides of life. And any moment in our life where we don't see both sides, we have an incomplete magnet, which magnetizes us to repeat that cycle until we see the whole magnet.
It's very important material here you're talking about. In Buddhism, this would be the third way. In Kabbalah, it's the center pillar. It's certainly what's been missing in politics, and we're seeing a little bit of it this week. I hope we can hang.
Yeah, there's a change going on there.
I'm so tired of hearing people talk about energizing the base. You know, screw the base. What about America? The base wasn't in New Orleans. We saw what happened there. So this is a very important philosophical concept, isn't it?
Well, I believe, you know, I was 18 years old. I was sitting in my parents' house. I was devouring philosophers and theologians at the time. I came across a German philosopher, Leibniz, Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz. He and Newton were the ones that simultaneously emerged the calculus, the mathematics. And the calculus, actually, which is a tool in mathematics to get the infinitesimals, was actually theologically driven because they wanted to know what it was like to actually come to presence.
The monad.
The monad, as Leibniz described in his monadology and theodicy. So what was interesting is I was exploring this book, The Discourse on Metaphysics by Leibniz. He said in the first chapter, there's a divine perfection, a divine beauty, a divine love, a divine magnificence that permeates the universe that most do not understand or are even aware of. Those that do, their lives are changed forever. Those that do not, they whisk through life, blown by the winds of change and opinion. And I said to myself with tears in my eyes because it touched me, I said, I want to know what that is. And then I dedicate my life to finding a way to help people experience that. That's what the method's about.
Dr. John D. Martini, my guest on Impact, 1:30 this afternoon. We have two guests today. You may know John from The Secret, this groundbreaking DVD that everybody's talking about, and you'll see soon if you haven't seen already. I've talked to people, and they insist they've seen it 15 or 20 times and get something more out of it each time. Let's follow on to this idea of what Stephen Hawking, I've heard him refer to the ultimate grittiness of the universe, this tiniest.
Well, according to modern cosmology and physics, there's a concept called Planck's dimension. Max Planck is the one who created the concept of the quantum. And it is a very small, minuscule unit. It is, in space, it's 1 × 10⁻³ centimeters. In scientific notation, that means a tiny little
piece
space.
Yeah.
And since the speed of light is a relative constant, what happens is it travels that distance in 1 × 10⁻⁴ seconds. So this little unit of time and this little unit of space are the minimal units of existence. And everything in the universe is a multiple of that, an integer multiple of that. Now, what the alchemist at one time searched for is to find the universal solvent, that which is common to all things. So what the alchemist had looked for, which was the secret to the universe, you might say, was this thing that now Max Planck has compiled as the quantum. So when we look at it, everything in the universe, including our own consciousness, emerges from this quantum state. Space, time, energy, and matter, and consciousness, which is the link between them, all are quantum and quantum derivatives. And what's interesting is the physics and the laws that govern that, although debatable by some rationalists and metaphysicians, have been argued about whether it has anything to do with consciousness or not. There's a way of demonstrating, beyond question, the relationship between quantum physics and consciousness. And I have developed that in my methodology because we are actually taking people and demonstrating the non-locality and the entanglement principle of quantum physics in the seminars by having influencing people from distances, even across the world into different countries of Australia, and duplicating this over and over again to where people are just having their mouths open. Because the truth is our consciousness and space, time, energy, and matter are inseparable. And that's why the secret works. That's why the law of attraction manifests, because our innermost dominant thought truly does create an alteration in the field of space-time.
Isn't part of our problem that the idea of the divine being in all things, no matter how small, the church has always portrayed this as paganism and pantheism, and they've killed people, slaughtered millions of people for saying God is in things.
Well, this also, if we go back to the pre-Christian times and the early Christian writings, you'll see in the other Bible, because Barnstone wrote a book called The Other Bible, and he went through the Dead Sea Scrolls, and then there was obviously the Gnostic Nakamati Library, and there's a lot of scrolls there, and they're still finding scrolls. I have a friend who lives on the ship that I live on who has $1.4 billion worth of rare collectible scrolls, and he's got a large place. He's got the original Aristotle that's available.
Wow.
He's an amazing guy. And I've been blessed to go through some of these and see his collection. And there is a vast amount of information that is being left out of the common pathway of the orthodoxy of church. And when we go and explore there, we will realize that the wisdom of the Christ consciousness, which is an equilibrated mind, a state of equanimity, a state of single-mindedness instead of double-mindedness where most of us live, is the entrance into that quantum state. The physicist Bose said, when you enter into a Bose state, a boson state, you can have an infinite number of things in an infinitesimal space. When you enter into a fermion space, you have what they call Pauli exclusion principle, where you have only one thing in a space. And our consciousness has access to both of these states. We have access to an enlightened state where we can access domains of space-time that are beyond our senses. And we also have access to our local reality. And we have, I call it a sphere of consciousness, and then we have a sphere of our sensory awareness. Our sphere of sensory awareness is very finite and limited to and filtered by our value systems. But our sphere of consciousness transcends that and is capable of having non-local entanglement with all people. And so anyone we open the doorway through gratitude and love to, we have the ability to influence. And we enter into the Bose state. And the boson state is an amazing state where we literally, what the ancient metaphysicians may have called the Akashic state, mm-hmm. where we are now access to a field of consciousness that is collective.
Well, the time has come.
Yes, and we have this, and this is demonstrable and reproducible. This
we
is not something just abstract.
60, 70 years of quantum physics, but it's too freaky for most people to get their brains around. That's the problem.
Well, no matter how far you explore it, there's a thing that I'm working on right now called the fine structure constant. And this is a very unique mathematical ratio that's found in physics, dealing with Planck's constant, light, gravitational things, and the masses of particles. And there's a ratio there that when that ratio is put together, space and time are out of the equation. And there's speculation that whoever comes up with a solution to this equation and why it comes out the number 1 over 137 is definitely the Nobel Prize, because I believe that this little equation has access to what happens to our consciousness when we actually dissolve the fabric of space-time. You know, I'm a firm believer that whenever we have emotions and we have an infatuation, that's like a positron, a positive charge, and we're attracted. When we have the other emotion where we have resentment, that's like a negatron or an electron, that's a negative charge. Whenever we do, we have mass. And whenever we have mass, we are altering the fabric of space-time, according to Wheeler. And so what we do is when we have emotions, we distort the fabric of space-time and we gravitationally pull ourselves down and weigh ourselves down into our grave, if you will. And gravity and grave comes to the same roots.
Really?
And just as gravita, the reproduction, because when we're in mass consciousness, the more mass conscious and more weighted we do, the more fertility and mortality we have in conscious awareness. And we tend to reproduce children that represent disowned parts of ourselves in order for us to learn to love those parts. So there's a correlation between gravity, gravida, and grave, because those are our mortal states.
How can people find out more about your workshop this weekend in L.A.?
They can probably call 1-888-DMartini.
Oh, that's handy.
1-888-DMartini.
You would need to know how to spell
D-E-M-A-R-T-I-N-I.
Martini.
Or they can just go to DMartini website, Dr. DMartini website.
Spell the DMartini again.
D-E-M-A-R-T-I-N-I.
Because I misspelled it on my website. Okay.
D-E-M-A-R-T-I-N-I.
Okay, so 1-800-DMartini.
No, 1-888.
1-888.
DMartini.
And the website again?
DrDMartini.com.
Doctor spelled out?
Don't, just DR, okay. DMartini.com.
But no periods.
Yeah, if you could just go to John DMartini and look that up, you'll find it'll take you to it.
And do you have books?
I have a number of books. I have I wrote a book called Count Your Blessings, The Healing Power of Gratitude and Love.
Is that the one we should begin with?
That's the one we talked about in gratitude. And it is, I was born on Thanksgiving Day in America, so I think there's some birthright there. But Count Your Blessings. I have another book called The Breakthrough Experience, which is a, you might say, a summary of the course. I have another book, You Can Have an Amazing Life in Just 60 Days, and another one called How to Make One Hell of a Profit and Still Get to Heaven, and a new one coming out called The Heart of Love.
Great. I have, I certainly wish I had more time for you. We'll have to have you back next time you're in Los Angeles.
I'd love to do that.
Okay. Have your people give me a call, and we'll book a whole hour with you. I've heard it attributed to different people, this quote I'm going to ask you about finally. I believe it's Meister Eckhart, but others have, I've heard it, St. Augustine and others, that if the only prayer we ever said was one of gratitude, that would suffice.
Augustine definitely referred to that, and Meister Eckhart definitely passed that torch forward, and I can say the same. I always say when we have gratitude is the key that opens up the gateway of the heart and allows the love that lives there eternally to shine outward. And what that does, that field of radiation that comes out of it, clears the consciousness, brings certainty to the mind and presence to the mind, inspiration to the mind, and enthusiasm to the body, which then magnetizes our innermost dominant thought into our outermost tangible reality.
I'm thinking of Jim Morrison, 30 years ago, screaming out that line, "You cannot petition the Lord with prayer." And here we are treating God like he's Santa Claus, give me this, give me that, and you're saying, how about thanks for what we've already got?
The greatest of prayer is not a human will projected onto divine plane, but divine plane permeating human will with gratitude.
Beautiful. So nice to meet you. And thanks for being on the show. The Secret is exciting. So, and you said you were under the impression that Larry King show was going to be.
I was told that Larry King is going to be playing again, I believe, on Saturday. I'm not certain.
With all you guys, a bunch of you guys.
Yeah, I think they're doing a replay on Saturday.
Okay, so check your local listings for that. Dr. John DMartini, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
We'll look for you again sometime.
Thank you so much.
This is InterVision on KPFK. Stay tuned. We're going to talk about a book called Beyond the History of Jesus, Beyond the Biography of Jesus, and what was the church doing all that time? Pulling certain books together and ignoring a lot of other stuff. Stay tuned. There's more on InterVision. Michael Benner, this is KPFK.
KPFK is testing its emergency alert system. This has been a test of the emergency alert system. KPFK serves the greater Los Angeles area.
And that we simply cannot impose our will on another people, and especially when we have absolutely no understanding of their culture.
They're shooting at you and you're killing them, and killing people is hardly a way to liberate them.
Sundays, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. That's Sundays, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m.
Soldiers are beginning to ask themselves, am I making these sacrifices for a good cause? Am I being lied to? Is this fraudulent?
I hope these stories are tools to help us figure out a way to stop the war.
That's Sunday, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Tune in to KPFK.
Tune in to hear revolutionary media broadcasting.
And what effect does demonstrating in the streets have upon setting the agenda and changing policy?
That's Sundays, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Get your weekly Sunday public affairs fix. 90.7 in L.A., 98.7 Santa Barbara. Live worldwide at kpfk.org.
And until next time, peace and love remain strong.
Hello, this is Blaise Bonpain. Please listen to World Focus this Sunday, KPFK Los Angeles, 90.7, 98.7 Santa Barbara. My guest will be Joshua Holland, a columnist for Alternet. 10 a.m., Sunday morning, KPFK Los Angeles.
That's it. Right here in the middle of Los Angeles, KPFK, at the heart and soul of the whole thing. This is InterVision till 2 o'clock this afternoon. My name is Michael Benner. My second guest for the balance of the hour today is Alexander Shaya. And Alexander is the author of a book entitled Beyond the Biography of Jesus. And you got to help me with a subtitle because that's got a new word in it for me.
It's got a new word that I coined, Journey of Quadratus.
And that's the four books of the New Testament?
It is the four traditional Christian Gospels.
How did you come to write this book?
Long story.
It's
been working on me for 30 years. 7 years ago on a cold night in New Mexico where I live. I had a moment, an epiphany, a revelation, however you want to say that. And 5 years of research, and 2 years later, now the book.
And what was the epiphany? Write this book?
The epiphany was that the early Christians were looking for four texts. And this has been generally known for a long time, but no one has ever been able to describe why four. Why was the number four so important that it was going to determine the number of the Gospels that were going to be put into, quote-unquote, the official canon. And a great love of the Dead Sea Scrolls and all the latest findings and the papyri, etc. But there is a reason beyond politics and patriarchy about why these were the four.
Now, Dr. DeMartini just mentioned the Nag Hammadi Gospels, so-called Gnostic Gospels, the Dead Sea Scrolls, and other scrolls lesser known that have been discovered, and I guess they're still being discovered, still being translated and worked with. Is what you're talking about part of the resistance of the church to want to know about these new revelations? Because they're stuck on four?
The church is stuck on four for a very important reason, which, to the title of the book, has nothing to do with the biography of Jesus. It has everything to do with what John was just talking about in terms of spiritual practice and consciousness. And there's a phenomenal story underneath the four Gospels that makes them a whole different order than anything else that was left aside.
And so when you start talking about numbers, I'm thinking not of what we know of as numerology, but and my wife is the expert on this, gematria, the old Jewish Kabbalistic approach to letters and numbers representing the same thing. Is that part of what we're talking about? Is this gematria?
It's part of it in this way. The very first person who we have any written record of as talking about why we were going to choose four Gospels is Bishop Irenaeus. The year is 180. Irenaeus's people are being horribly massacred, and he wants to give his people the right spiritual text to pray. And the very first thing he says is, we're going to choose four texts because all natural and divine law is his word quadriform. I took his word quadriform and restated it in something I think of as much more poetic, quadratus. In essence, what Irenaeus was saying is that all great spiritual practice is built on four questions and the four spiritual practices which flow out of those questions. Underneath that is universal consciousness, Christ consciousness. It's being described as you just heard in terms of quantum physics, et cetera, et cetera. But there is a story underneath the four Gospels set in a very particular sequence. And the four questions are, how do we face change? How do we endure suffering? What's the meaning of joy? And how do we serve? And each one of these gospel texts was chosen because it gave the question and the practice to one of those questions. The Gospel of Matthew was chosen because it answers the question of how we lean into or welcome change. I love the phrase today, how we welcome insecurity.
Hmm. I've never heard these. I've done a lot of reading. Is this something you intuited, you realized, something you discovered through empirical research?
Both. 30 years of working to find this answer. And then in a night, on a very cold night with a very dim light, you're sitting there. And I had a spurious thought that came through my heart. And in a moment, I saw this entirely new picture that no one has ever been able to describe before about how and why these four were chosen and the particular reading sequence that they were putting in. Most people today don't realize that for 1,000 years, Christianity read the Gospels in a very definite sequence. And the belief was is that the sequence held an entire story, so that the story is not just in one of the Gospels. You start reading the Gospel of Matthew. You come to the end of the Gospel of Matthew, and it leaves you interiorly in your heart and consciousness exactly where the Gospel of Mark opens. You read the Gospel of Mark, it leaves you where the Gospel of John opens. John is the third Gospel in the sequence. You read the Gospel of John, and it leaves you interiorly exactly where the Gospel of Luke opens. Mm. And the reason that the early Christians could so clearly intuit this is that they already knew that the cycle of spiritual practice is you face change. As you face change, you seem to move into a time of great suffering. Suffering is largely, as we just heard, about a dual perspective, and duality is never the truest nature of the universe. It's always unity. Once you move through that duality and are back in a place of unity, you receive the joy. And then the question is always got to be asked, how does the joy serve? Who does the joy serve? It's the great grail question, which opens up the fourth gospel, which is Luke. This design will, as I go around the country and speak to all manner of mainline Christian churches, they have the keys to unlock the puzzle, but they've got to step out of their 100 years of scriptural scholarship, which is based on defining Jesus, and realize that Christianity was not built on a cult of personality.
Yes, yes, yes. Boy, do I.
But is built on a universal process of transformation.
I call it worshiping the mailman, well, you know, and certainly Christ merits worship. Especially the Christos part, if not the Jesus part.
The Christos, but one of the most impressive things about this is Paul is the one who gives us the name the Christos, which is his translation of the Arabic or Aramaic word. And I grew up first generation Lebanese, and Aramaic was my language of worship in church. The word in Aramaic is Messiha. Now, in English, most people describe that as the Messiah.
Right.
In Aramaic, Messiha, the word itself has the experience that's being described, the breath of God, Messiha. Now, when Paul has to take Messiha and make it Christos, we're still talking about the anointing, but we moved away from the fact that the Messiha is the breath of God, which has been there since before the first moment of creation, that actually creation is the breath of God.
Is that the same as in Genesis, the word?
It's the same as the word in Genesis, but even more powerfully, it's the same as what John opens with. In the beginning was the word. In the beginning was the Messiha. In the beginning was God's breath.
This is in shamanic traditions that God breathes the world into existence.
God breathes the world into existence.
And also, keep your word. I give you my word. And air and the basic elements, too. There's the four basic elements.
Well, which Irenaeus spoke of. Irenaeus spoke of the four elements and the four winds and the four points of the compass, which was all his poetic restatement of the four great spiritual practices.
Because threes and sevens always come up for me when I study mysticism and such. The three, of course, is the ongoing argument about the Trinity.
Right.
Christians, Catholics can't seem to get that one worked out, although there's some fascinating ancient stuff about the threeness of things, right? Pythagoras and old Hermetic philosophy. And there's something I read once in Revelation, I think, about seven spirits before the throne. Have you ever heard that phrase?
Well, I have, but let's not go there. Let's talk about how seven is the fundamental number of transformation. But that seven can be described in a sequence of four. In the four gospel sequence, the first gospel has two practices. The second gospel, one. The third gospel, two. The fourth gospel, two, which makes seven. And the old anthropologist in me that studied world culture and world rites of initiation, most systems of initiation talk about a sequence of seven. And it's there in the four. But because I'm writing a book which is helping Christianity reopen to the deep truth that has in the traditional four, I want to stay in that metaphor.
I presume you were raised in Lebanon as a Christian.
I was raised in Birmingham, Alabama.
You said of Lebanese
Christian
descent. Okay.
First generation. My grandparents came across with my parents in their arms.
What prompted you to ask these questions when so many Christians seem not to be interested in asking these kinds of questions?
I had a phenomenal childhood growing up in a Lebanese village by the old ways in the heart of Birmingham, Alabama, which was not kind to immigrants. And my grandparents gave me a love for the poetry of the Gospels. And the poetry of the Gospels did something for my heart in my prayer that I've never forgotten. And I'm very sad that so many people today can't feel the texts because we've had a century of scholarship which has left it in boxes describing an individual rather than letting it breathe as the deepest revelation of the structure of the universe. And something about that Aramaic, Arabic sense of the Gospels stayed in me. And I didn't know that I was becoming so dedicated to finding a way for them to breathe again.
Well, to me, that's the mystical approach. And correct me if I misunderstand you, but part of the debate seems to be, do we take all of this stuff literally? Which I just don't understand how you could, since Christ is teaching in parables. He says he holds up a mustard seed. I mean, what? This is how to plant mustard? Right. I mean, it's obviously parable and metaphor and allegory. And it does become so rich and so transcendent, so breathtaking sometimes, that how could you not want to know that stuff and go beyond this controlling, manipulative idea that, oh, and by the way, the preacher says, when I mean literal the way I interpret it to be literal.
Right. And so we've got some conflicts in the scriptures that today's scholarship cannot resolve. It's like the old Einstein. You cannot resolve these problems at the level of these problems.
Yes, with the same mind that, right, that created the problem.
So in Matthew, the text of Matthew says that Jesus the Christ is born in a house, that Mary and Joseph live in Bethlehem and Jesus is born in their home. The Gospel of Luke gives us the more famous text that Mary and Joseph live in Nazareth and they have to get on a mule and go to Bethlehem. They can't find room in the inn and Jesus is born in a stable. Now, that the four Gospels are rife with those sorts of inaccuracies or discrepancies. No American court of law is going to say that you can have an eyewitness where one eyewitness says Jesus was born in a stable and the other one says Jesus was born in a house. Which is it, folks?
Yeah.
When you understand that the Gospel of Matthew is about how you lean into change and insecurity, Jesus the Christ is born in your home. Jesus Christ is born in your everyday normal reality, today's consciousness. Something begins to break through in the middle of just an average bowl of soup. When you're asking the question of service, which is the Gospel of Luke, then we've got to talk about Jesus Christ being born in a place which is dank and dark with a very particular aroma, because that's precisely where the question of service starts in us, in those places which are not in our homes. We're out on the road. We're long away from the place of security and comfortableness.
Alexander Shaya, my guest on Inner Vision for the second half of the show today. Alexander is an author. He's written a marvelous book that he's telling us a little bit about this afternoon called Beyond the Biography of Jesus. And the subtitle, again, is
The Journey of Quadratus.
Quadratus. So we're talking about those four four Gospels that comprise the central teachings of the New Testament. You know, Alexander, one of my I was raised Catholic, so we never looked at the Bible.
I was raised Catholic, too, but I did look at the Bible.
I was so busy memorizing the catechism that it was much later in life that I thought, you know, it might be a good idea to read this thing. And I have, of course, and again and again. One of my favorite passages, and I believe it only shows up in two of the four books, is Christ walking on water. Mm-hmm. What do you think that story is about?
Well, Michael, you've just asked a question of biography in some sense, because the question always is, which author uses it and where do they put it in their text? For instance, the Gospel of Mark was written to the Christian community in Rome as they were under a death sentence. They were being horribly executed by Nero because they had been blamed for the fire of Rome. Jews of the first century are phobic about water. They actually believed that water was the place that the demons reside. Mark places the text of Jesus walking on the water and the text of the disciples out in the boat at night in a storm to talk about the Christ, consciousness, spiritual reality, that can move into the place, to the places of our deepest concerns, anxiety, depression, and live there, and live through it. So in each one of the Gospels, where the story is placed, and in the context of how that author was speaking to the spiritual practice that his community needed, is the more important question than the story about, quote-unquote, Jesus walking on water. Jesus walking on water is a question of biography. Gospel of Mark is the question, how do you live through suffering?
So you don't go farther than that with it? You don't look at what that might mean? I mean, as a lesson about how to deal with fear?
Absolutely.
Calming your emotional nature or anything like that?
Absolutely. The Christ is leading us into our storms. The Christ is not protecting us from our storms.
Isn't that interesting?
And in the
it reminds me of that aphorism. Have you ever heard the kite rises against the wind, mm-hmm. not with it? Mm-hmm. He leads us into our storms.
Right.
To face our fear.
To face our fears. And actually, I would say, like your first guest this afternoon, the Christ is leading us to a deep experience of the tension and duality. Because only as we move into the deep experience of duality does it finally open up in our hearts as unitive.
Wow. Another of the miracles, the very first one, I believe, changing water to wine. Many Christians think that, to drink alcohol is a horrible thing. And yet right. here the very first miracle is water. Well, hell, it's a wedding. Let's have some wine. Again, you're going to tell me.
Third gospel.
Yeah.
Asking the question of joy and the meaning of joy. We have walked the spiritual practice through Matthew and Mark. We turn now to the opening of the Gospel of John, and we hear about water that becomes wine. We hear about the inner transformation in us through the miracle and the mystery of the Christ. Our water, our lives is not simply for subsistence. It's about abundance and joy. It's about fullness, and it's about unity. It's about understanding that water and wine are the same substance.
Is it also about redemption, uplifting, salvation? Is it?
We could have very deep theological conversations about each one of those words.
Well, I mean, you mentioned alchemy. That's lead to gold.
Yep.
And throughout the history, the idea of leavened bread right. also is an allegory for this uplifting, this right. salvation. The prostitute that becomes the virgin, in a sense, or the water that is lifted to spirits. I mean, they call them spirits, right?
Right, right.
I always thought these were, in some way, if not the whole story, because I think you're right, all of this is real complex, and I love your postulate here. But could be a allegory for the idea of uplifting, of salvation, of redemption. It's not something that just happens once when you die, but many times.
Over and over, and that's why this four gospel reading sequence was repeated in the Christian church on 3 years of Sundays, over and over and over and over, and for 1,000 years. Christians read the four Gospels in the sequence on Sunday morning until the 13th century. And for some very sad reason, it dissolved.
Now, let's do it again. You're saying, and we have people just joining us now as well, I'm sure, but having spoken to you for a few minutes, I'm getting a better idea of this now. You're saying these four Gospels appear, there's only four of them for a reason, because of the magical nature of the number four, the four directions, and so on and so forth.
And the four spiritual practices.
Okay. And each of these books in this order represent which four questions?
The Gospel of Matthew, which is the first in the sequence, is about how we lean into the experience of change. The Gospel of Mark, second, is about enduring places of deep suffering. The Gospel of John, which is third in the ancient sequence, is the receiving of joy and pondering it for its meaning. The Gospel of Luke, which is the fourth in the sequence, is the Gospel of how do we serve. The Gospel of Luke bends back around again to the top of the cycle, and the Gospel of Matthew.
I see. Well, that's a fascinating idea. How about other academics in the field, other religious scholars of Christianity, especially the cosmic Christ, the metaphysicians and quantum physicists that look at Christianity with perhaps a broader gaze, a more comprehensive point of view? Are you reaching out to them? Are they?
Michael, I'm reaching out to everyone. I'm reaching to the broad spectrum in Christianity and outside of Christianity. One of the things that I am most excited about by this book is Jack Kornfield, from a Buddhist perspective, has said, immediately, I understand how this is the same expression as the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism. Sylvia Boorstein, from her Buddhist and Jewish perspective, is saying, I know this pattern both in insight meditation and also in the great story of the Jews coming out of Egypt. I just got an email 2 weeks ago from an Islamic scholar in Australia writing to tell me, I know Quadratus in Islam. And I'm like, please teach me. I don't know that. So if the idea of Quadratus is true, then it must be true for all of us. And, of course, each one of us will make this idea our own metaphor, our own spiritual practice. It's there in the Kabbalah. It's there in Native American rites of initiation. And it's fundamentally the principle that ordered the choice of the four Gospels and then placed them in a particular sequence.
Yeah, we sure like the number four. There's no question about it. It's nice and square. And again, we think of what do they call them, compass points,
right.
The four compass points, the four directions and such. You're talking about Christianity in the context of a Buddhist philosophy. Do you personally have any feelings about the missing years from 12, when Christ was 12 and then 30 you think maybe he went to Hindustan to study some Buddhism or Hinduism?
Jesus may have traveled greatly. Again, with this book, I'm bringing us away from the biography, because if we think that to transform Christianity, we need to discover more about the biography, we're going to be in this mess a long time. Christianity, if it will understand that the choice of these four was ordered because of spiritual practice, and there's a grace and a mystery and a consciousness that lives in each one of those spiritual practices, Christianity can begin to move again. Our culture can begin to move again.
It saddens me sometimes that people who often claim to be the most faithful know the least about other religions.
Yeah.
Do you think it's incumbent upon a good Christian to have at least a modicum of knowledge about the other major religions, especially perhaps?
I do. One of my best theology professors at the University of Notre Dame was a great person by the name of John Dunn. And John said, it's incumbent upon every Christian to do what he calls crossover into other traditions, other cultures, and other faiths, and then come back home with a wider and more compassionate perspective.
I don't think most religious people even know that all religions have mystical traditions that are much more inclusive and unitive, harmonious, if not unitive. And I mean, even the Sufis, my God, the Sufis are just, and yet people think, oh, Islam, those are crazy suicide bombers. And, oh, my God, the Sufis, look at the Sufis and the Kabbalists, and sort of relegated to the Hasidics. But no, there's this rich tradition there. Rosicrucianism, responsible for founding democracy, and we know nothing about it.
Right.
It's just stunning to me that we can get this far into the game. And most wars are fought out of religious ignorance. My God, no, my God, like school, you know, little children.
And there are two messages that I've got with this book right now. One is welcome in security. Whatever the new culture, the new spirit, the new world, welcome in security. That's the only way we're going to get there.
Get used to
and
it.
Secondly, look for the unitive. Look through our dualism to the unitive. It's there. It's waiting for us. It'll grow in our hearts.
Yeah, I like the triune model of harmony in the center. There's unity on one end, the spiritual wholeness of things, and incredible diversity and uniqueness on the dual end. But it's the center, the heart and soul. That's the harmony of it all, I think. So
beautiful.
Yeah. There's a little riddle about how does the one create the many, and it's through love, through the Christos, through that harmonious nature that unifies the one and the many. I think it's a rich concept.
Right. And from the Gospel of John, aligned with our mother faith, Judaism, we can talk about Yerushalom, the place where diversity is bended into harmony.
We're all out of time. Alexander Shaya, that's S-H-A-I-A, Shaya, Alexander Shaya. The name of your book again?
Beyond the Biography of Jesus, The Journey of Quadratus, and the website is quadratus.com.
Spell
Q-U-A-D. Quad, Q-U-A-D, R-A-T-O-S.
Great. Alexander Shaya, thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Appreciate you being here today in KPFK. Good luck with the book.
Thank you.
And your research.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. And thanks also to Dr. John DeMartini, who was our guest during the first half of the program today. Thanks to D'Angelo, our engineer, to Brooks, our producer, to Doreen Key, Mike Kim, Kurt Wyman, so many people that help us with this show. Also, podcast from my website at theagelesswisdom.com. As always, be gentle, love life, and take care of each other. This is Michael Bennett.